you want a vision of the future, Winston, imagine a boot stamping on a human face forever.
You want answers?
I think I'm entitled.
You want answers?
I want the truth! You can't handle the truth!
Someone is trying to teach me a lesson in futility. Why am I the only one who isn't killed?
They will run you dizzy. They will pile falsehood on top of falsehood until you can't tell a lie from the truth and you won't even want to. That's how the powerful keep their power. Don't you read the papers?
I just want to say one word to you. Just one word.
Yes, sir.
Are you listening?
Yes, sir, you.
Plastics.
I'm going to get your money for you. But if you don't get the President of the United States on that phone, you know what's going to happen to you?
What?
You're going to have to answer to the Coca-Cola company.
The world is a college of corporations, inexorably determined by the immutable bylaws of business. The world is a business, Mr. Beale. It has been since man crawled out of the slime.
Welcome to another episode of Our Interesting Times. It is my pleasure to have Russ Winter back on the show. Of course, Russ is a researcher, an independent researcher and proprietor of The New Nationalist. A New Nationalist, well, apparently that's a name change now. You changed the name. So, Russ, how are you doing?
pretty good, Tim. Are you still on YouTube?
Oh, yeah. Well, yeah, for the most part.
I've been kind of wondering how you were doing. I've been listening to some of the shows, and there's a lot of truth bombs there, my friend. It's got to be kind of on edge, aren't you?
Yeah, the trick is to just use some misspellings in the titles and the algorithms that the ADL and Southern Poverty Law Center have set up. They may not be catching me yet, so maybe that's the trick.
Yeah, there's little sly things you can do, including our name change of our site. We went to Winter Watch, which kind of was the name of my old site when I was writing about financials, and that's my name, of course, Winter, so it's kind of touchy, catchy that way. And I think the nationalist brand has just been really falsely tarnished, you know, through the Charlottesville incident, which I think was a staged deception, and just the constant canards against it, that it's too much of a trigger word, and sometimes you can't even get into your material, what you actually have to say, what you actually have to write about. And so we just thought, let's just get that out of the way, make a name change, go with something that I was using before anyway. So yeah, you can find me at winterwatch.net.
Okay. So, apparent crackdown. I've discussed this on some recent shows about some of these platforms, whether it's Google or YouTube, Facebook, and these things, citing terms and conditions to get rid of, content providers who aren't reading from the playbook or reading from the script. And so they decide just to cut them off. And it's a way that in this new digitized internet age where we increasingly rely more and more on for communication, commerce, and everything, you can successfully ostracize someone for being an ideological, philosophical miscreant.
Well, just to give you an indication how disingenuous they are, I was banned from our conspiracy, the Reddit conspiracy site, where I contribute articles there regularly, and the reason for the ban was spamming. So there seems to be sort of a misunderstanding of what the word spamming means. That usually means unwanted material.
Yes.
And I was posting materials that got 14, 15,000 Karma votes, and it was pretty well received over there. So some functionary, let's call him that, decided to invent a newspeak term, spamming, to ban my site. And actually it's the third time it happened. And I had one guy, one mod that kind of came to my rescue on the other two occasions. And I just wrote him and said, I'm done with your site, and I'm going to spend some time trashing it.
So, yeah, it's what they've done is, they cite, well, we're a private corporation, and we can decide who and who we don't want to do business with or include on our platforms here. But really, I've made this point, others have made this point, that Silicon Valley in general, but these telecoms and Google and Facebook have been lavished with funds from the federal government, more particularly from the national security state. InQtel funded Facebook at like $13 million. It wasn't just Peter Thiel's little $500,000 that he gave to Mark Zuckerberg, So they've been set up. Same with Google. Google is huge. Was set up with money from the CIA and from the National Security NSA, National Security Agency, so really this whole infrastructure built on taxpayers' dime. And so there's no really clear, I mean, like I said, it's like they're private the same way that Lockheed Martin or Northrop Grumman is private. Yeah, it's a joke. And
right.
And really, and if you do offer a platform that advertises, get out and you can express yourself, which they all do, free speech, blog, express yourself, whether it's you're talking about cooking, the weather, sports, or even politics, geopolitics, and these things. And then suddenly you pull the rug out from someone. You really have, and especially if you charge them money for it, and a lot of these sites do, they have introductory offers that are free, but to post any meaningful content, you have to pay for it. Then they just, without any notice, they shut your site down. They don't even give you notice to switch to another platform. My opinion, that's bad faith, and there's probably a legal claim there that they're in violation of a contract and false advertisement.
Well, they'll take them into the right court to handle that. So the court's pretty much handled. Yeah, and, the claim is they're going after conservatives and right-wingers and that kind of thing, but that's not true because I'm seeing a lot of progressive anti-war people. They're being taken. I'm seeing alternative medicine, alternative health.
But, They've really been raked
over the coals.
Yeah, you wouldn't think that was a partisan issue, but yeah. I think it was, Health Ranger was taken down or something? Mike Adams?
Oh, yeah, a bunch of them. And so they're basically that's corporatists doing that.
Yeah, because they don't want any alternative medicine information getting out there because informed patients, consumers might not blindly listen to advice of the allopathic medical doctors and the Rockefeller medicine, industry that's been constructed over the past century, And just a little bit of competing information. Like I said, it's very expensive to maintain lies. It's like you got to shovel BS uphill with a very expensive bulldozer, and the truth just naturally goes. You don't need any. You don't need massive. Yeah. And so really, they got to constantly fight this with billions and billions and billions of dollars, of fakery and lies and distortions. Because just a little bit of truth, just like a little bit of light. It breaks the darkness, and that's what we're seeing there. So
that's what they're up against, exactly.
So, well, today I wanted to talk to you about you've been writing a series of articles. I think last time I spoke to you, I thought I wanted to devote a discussion to it. Was this notion of the Parasite Guild, or sort of this global criminal enterprise that's looting the world, and they have a specific method or methodology to do this. And you think you kind of spell it out. You make the connections, you name some names, and kind of go through the process of how this is done. Basically, it's debauched currency and debt and gunboat diplomacy. So the Parasite Guild, what is the Parasite Guild, and how do they get away with it?
Well, I mean, you have the ability to print money, first of all, through the central bank. So it pretty much gives them the international banking, a very cheap source of money to pretty much do what they please, engage in different kinds of arbitrage, currency, and issue debt, a lot of debt. And so there's no constraints on the debt. And so the first step of a Parasite Guild operation, and we can get into a good example, which is Argentina. We'll go back and hit the history of that. That'll be part of the show to kind of really get you some detail of how it's done. The first step is the cabal or the banksters prime these unsustainable bubbles. And then they, in the process, they're sloughing off the caca or the shit on unsuspecting and planned patsies in a monster wealth transfer. And that was best expressed just this weekend by a certain Janet Yellen in a speech at the Brookings Institute. And Janet says, "By keeping the interest rates unusually low after the zero lower bound no longer binds, the lower than..." I'm trying to sound like Woody Allen, but maybe I'm not doing very good. The lower for long approach promises, in effect, to allow the economy to boom. The Federal Open Market Committee needs to make a credible statement endorsing such an approach, ideally before the next downturn. In other words, just keep blowing bubbles.
Mm-hmm.
Never let the bubbles build it. Just blow a bigger bubble. Well, that's what they've been doing. I mean, she's just saying that. She's just kind of hinting that we need to get back to that because, we've raised interest rates next week up all the way up to 2%, and we've contracted our balance sheet by a whooping 5% from $4.5 trillion to $4.25 trillion, and therefore something might break. Well, something probably will break, and so she's just addressing it already by saying, let's blow another bubble. So that's how the system sets up these trades, or sets up this abuse is really what it is. And the bubble phases can kind of go in iterations. They'll do one, then they'll pop it, and then they'll do another one. They keep blowing the bubbles. But every time it happens, there's a monster wealth transfer. And the wealth just keeps piling up, and anybody that looks at any kind of income statistics around the world can see it. And you have to ask yourself, how did all these hedge funds guys get so wealthy? You know, Bill Gates, I guess I kind of get, maybe, even though he's a monopolist, but why are there so many wealthy hedge fund managers? Why are there so many wealthy banksters? Why do they have all the money? Well, it's because of this system they have. So the second step is they short and facilitate a rout or a crash of the debt bubble. And I think that's coming. I've been saying that for a while now, but I think it's building up to that. And I think that actually it's not that far ahead because, like I say, they're pulling back the balance sheet. And you've already had a lot of trouble in the developing markets in Turkey and Argentina again, Brazil. There's just constant currency routes. Well, that's because these guys borrow in dollars, and then they pull a little bit of the dollars out of the money out of the markets, and they're the first ones to get shut off. You know, shut up from the spigot.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's why the problems develop in these developing countries so often. And then the third step is the crisis or collapse stage, and the parasite guild operators, and that's again your hedge funds, Kenneth Dart and Paul Elliott Singer in Argentina are the two classic examples. They'll swoop in right after the collapse and pick up the debt for pennies on the dollar. So right in the midst of the collapse, which they'll trigger the collapse, and all they got to do is just say, no, we're not giving you any more loans, just like that. And if a country like the United States, which is $22 trillion in debt and has 115% debt to GDP, is totally dependent on this constant flow of funds. And so any interruption in that, it's over. Turn off the lights. You have a crisis. And so they've set up the whole world that way. And then after the debt crashes, they work it to, you know, try to get a little rally in the debt so they can trade that, or they'll do extortions. They'll try to pick up the economic gems through privatization operations. And then finally, the final step is that anybody that's still solvent in any kind of country is robbed to pay off the debts in full. And the key mechanism for that will, in this cycle, will be bank deposit bail-ins, which they've already set up, particularly in Europe. So if a bank fails – they can go after your deposit, even though they consider you a creditor of the bank. That's just unprecedented. That's just opens it up for complete abuse. And they've made it very, very clear that they're going to clean out pension funds as well. And I don't know if you ever saw the movie that Steve Bannon made. If anybody's seen the movie, I'm trying to grab the name of it right now. Anyway, he made a movie. I'll probably come up with it here in a second. That was you watch it, and he goes into all the talking points of somebody that's kind of conservative.
Mm-hmm.
But it kind of leads you down the path of, you know, we're spoiled. Spoiled as a country. People have been given so much benefits for and asking so little in people's pensions, for example, and Social Security. And you sit there and you go, oh my God, he's making a documentary about stealing people's pensions and Social Security.
Yeah, it's right about selling austerity, yeah.
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 Yeah. In a really awful kind of way, because it kind of sucks you in. I mean, if you're on the conservative side of the aisle.
Yeah, pay your bills.
Pay your damn bills. Right, yeah, exactly. Yeah. You'll be responsible, but that's not really what the message of this documentary is. It's a premonition.
Well, that's how every man, the guy in the street, is taken advantage of through the manipulation of the currency and debt, because, well, he may follow that sort of, simple moral rule, is when you have these vultures that are engaged in constant currency manipulation, that's what really it is, those rules don't apply. And so you have to start kind of thinking these things on multiple levels, yeah.
Well, the thing that people really need to ask is, why do currencies trade like pork bellies?
Yes.
They shouldn't be that way. And so there's some kind of a triggering going on, and there's a lot of leverage in currencies, and you can lean on them, and you can really manipulate. And we've got very manipulated markets and an awful lot of gaming going on, and they can pull the plug on anybody at any time, any country in the world they please. So the whole Parasite Guild articles that I wrote kind of work back to remind people, because I don't think people realize it, is there was a time when this stuff kind of behavior wasn't acceptable.
Yeah.
And that's like back in the, after the central banks were pretty much established in the United States, there's a period where people really criticized it. There's one German economist by the name of Gottfried Fedor. I mean, he has really been delegated to the memory hole, but that guy just nailed it. He really did. He's unfortunately, he's considered to be the godfather of the 1930s German economic miracle.
So he's therefore he's a Nazi. So he can't.
Yeah, he advised him on economics. He wasn't really a Nazi. Mm-hmm. He was just basically he had an economic point of view that Nazis adopted. He wrote a book called The Abolition of Interest Slavery. And I listened to it, and I'm looking at my old article dated July 28th, 2016, and wouldn't you know it, sorry, this video does not exist. It's a two-hour audio version translation of Gottfried Fedor's Das Manifest der Brechtgug, der, whatever the word in English, the abolition of interest slavery. You can't find this on the internet anymore. But essentially what he said, to kind of summarize it, the short version of this rabbit hole, is kick out the Rothschilds and the banksters, and Fedor called it plutocratic big loan capital, and issue legal tender, which are vouchers for completed labor or greenbacks, to cancel national debt. And to deal with the parasite guildas, the first debt to be exchanged would be the certificates held abroad that would be paid off at a discount. So you just completely flip the whole system over to based upon completed labor and small capital. Fedor was a big believer in small capitalism. He did not really want to abolish capitalism. Mm-hmm. He wanted to reform it to make it small, local, decentralized, servicing the needs of local merchants, local farmers, which is exactly how it should be.
Yeah, instead of big banks, credit unions, local banks, and these things that have interest in the value of the community and the stability of the community.
Yeah, because the big problem in the world is this plutocratic big capital. You know, they want to loan. They always want to loan money to the governments, and they'll install people that are complete morons and get them to borrow as much as they can, get these countries in trouble, and then destroy them.
That's
the system.
If you wonder why that's, your outrageous spending, and then, but just below that, you're familiar with, was it the Clara Piven plan? That was
right.
These two sociologists that idea was you bankrupt the state to bring on a crisis, and so you have academics coming up with these ideas. How you bring about a revolution just through a fomented crisis by just irresponsible spending, reckless spending and debt. Well, behind them are probably these oligarchs and banksters who want the government to continue borrowing money from them, money that's which they, of course, create out of thin air and collect on interest. And I think, as you'll detail later on, is how this is used actually to foreclose on real assets, the blood, sweat, and treasure of the people.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. And it's all promoted. They've got these guys. One of them is Paul Krugman. And Paul Krugman, or the New York Slimes, they call it, New York Times, a.k.a. Slimes, will say things like, debt is one person's liability but another person's asset. What the hell is that? What? Paul, what the hell are you talking about? I mean, think about that. Think about that. And then you've got this Robert Shapiro of Yale University, who's one of Bill Clinton's boys, and he's heavily involved in just promoting debt, working with the IMF, just putting the rope around the necks of these countries and strangling them, and then the funds dry up. And then they put in this Washington consensus of austerity and swoop in and buy the country's debt at distressed prices, and then use the end goal is to extort, to privatize gain, and then have the public take the losses. And that's exactly what the friggin' Steve Bannon was talking about on that documentary. Mm-hmm. And it just sends a chill, for me, because I know about this abolition of interest rates, interest slavery. I know that the literature was there on this topic. People were talking about it. It just sends a chill up my back to just see it. And I know nobody gets it. Everybody's going, oh, Steve, you're so on top of this behavioral stuff and telling people to be more disciplined. But you got a whole network that's promoting this stuff.
Well, yeah, you also get in one article how, along with easy money and then debt, and compound interest, to that you have a psychological warfare game where the public is the mass public is demoralized and debased. So you debase the currency, and then you debase the values, and you get them addicted to the lifestyle that the easy money for a while kind of promotes. Sort of globalism, transient cultures. You get that high mobility, which appears, at least on a superficial level, to provide our opportunity and excitement to one's life. But this creates an atomized, rootless class of people.
Exactly.
Who can easily be manipulated by the globalists, the cosmopolitans, and the rootless cosmopolitans who have no loyalty to any particular area, soil. Of course, when you talk about blood and soil, someone immediately starts accusing you of being a Nazi.
Right.
Because... so that's the article about Greece, how Greece culture was fundamentally changed. There's also a documentary about Japan, about the easy money of the 80s and how that was used to fundamentally change Japanese culture. How through the monetary debasement, you can debase the culture. So.
Right. Well, I mean, John Perkins, who wrote the book, best-selling book, Confessions of an Economic Hitman, here's how he put it. He says, that's part of the game, convince people that they're wrong and that they're inferior, and the corporatocracy is incredibly good at that. It's a policy of them versus us. We are good, we are right, we do everything right, you're wrong. In this case, all the energy has been directed at the Greek people to say, you're lazy, you didn't do it right, the right thing, you didn't follow the right policies. And that's what Bannon was doing in his documentary.
Yeah, and the same thing with Puerto Rico that Wilbur Ross talked about, right?
Exactly.
Where
exactly
you can cook the books And you know, that's what they did in Greece. Goldman Sachs took the books so Greece could enter the EU and then access all that easy money for a while and go into that huge debt. And the next thing you know it, the banksters are eyeing the Acropolis.
Yeah, and you know, Wilbur Ross doesn't address the Wall Street's role in any of this. Mm-hmm. Well, you know, we just organized money, you know, Aunt Millie's money, and maybe Aunt Willie wants to buy some Puerto Rican muni bonds that we recommend. I mean, I was on Wall Street for 15 years. I know how this game. Don't play this crap with me, Wilbur. You can do this on the rest of the gullibles out there, but don't pull that on me. So yeah, this makes me very angry. So they end up with this plan, Kakistocracy.
Kakistocracy.
Yeah, the rule of the worst, and that really is how it works. Is you got to get some really bad people in there to put in place to run these operations at every end, at the government end. And so yeah, you look at it and you go, yeah, Puerto Rico put some bad people in there. Mm-hmm. Greece put some bad people in there. Argentina, which we'll talk about, did it. But then they co-opt and buy off the academics with grants. And then I kind of came across this little gem. I don't know if you saw this in my article. I'll read it to everybody. It's a list of timeless tips from the 1944 Simple Sabotage Field Manual written by CIA Bill Donovan. This just sounds like Greece.
So this is the OSS at this point.
Not the CIA, right? Yeah. The OSS.
That's funny.
The managers and supervisors. One, to lower morale and production, be pleasant to inefficient workers. Give them undeserved promotions. Discriminate against efficient workers and complain unjustly about their work. Two, demand written orders. Three, misunderstand orders. Ask endless questions or engage in long correspondence about such orders. Quibble over them when you can. Four, do everything possible to delay the delivery of orders. Even though parts of an order may be ready beforehand, don't deliver it until it is completely ready. Five, don't order new working materials until your current stocks have been virtually depleted. So that the slightest delay in filling your order will mean a shutdown. Six, order high-quality materials that are hard to get. If you don't get them, argue about it. Warn that inferior materials will mean inferior work. Seven, in making work assignments, always sign out the unimportant jobs first. See that the important jobs are assigned to inefficient workers of poor machines. Eight, insist on perfect work on relatively unimportant products. Send back for refinishing those that have the least flaws. Here's the advice for employees. Work slowly. Think of ways to increase the number of movements needed to do your job. Use a light hammer instead of a heavy one. Try to make a small wrench do instead of a big one. Organizations and conferences. When possible, refer all matters to committees for further study and consideration. Attempt to make the committees as large and bureaucratic as possible. Hold conferences when there is much more critical work to be done. That's what they did in Greece. They pretty much got the system put in place. And so now...
It's like being... This is a manual for sabotaging an economy. Now, in what context is this considered appropriate form of policy? This is the OSS, supposedly, at the time, fighting the Axis powers. But obviously, this is implemented post-war. But this gives you, when you're citing an economic problem, we look at it as sort of an act of nature. No one's really at fault for it. It just happened. It's a bust. We need regulations and these things. But behind the scenes, you have someone like Donovan writing this manual. Yeah. And it's how is something like this implemented? Well, it's implemented through NGOs or, agent provocateurs, agents sent in, compromised government leaders, a kakistocracy, correct? I mean, that's...
That's how they do it, a kakistocracy. And the thing is that what it does, it just creates a divide and conquer hatred and disgust, because if you're in the private sector and you know that all this abuse has been going on in the public sector, for example, you hate their guts. That just says, go ahead, privatize these suckers. Go ahead, get rid of these public assets, utilities, services, airports, harbors, telecommunication. Put them in the hands of private foreign investors and kleptocrats. They can run it better. Mm-hmm. And so just opens the door. That's the operation right there. So then and it kind of leaves the country in sort of a position where they're ingrained in the national psyche that they got to be aligned with some power, you know, operating as a vassal state.
There's no loyalty or sense of patrimony anymore in that condition. It's and yet you throw into the mix, mass immigration or cultural pluralism, as diversity, that really makes it worse, because now you lose, you know, the high trust society, which I'm not a fan of Swedish socialism, but to the extent that it worked, it probably was a function of the fact that it was a very homogenous society, and in that society you get a lot of just inbred accountability and loyalty to the people you're serving, and it makes it all the worse when you start to dilute the population, send in multicultural. Everyone becomes opportunistic and don't trust each other, and the system just collapses.
Well, yeah, then you also bring in people that don't really have any work skills at all.
Yeah.
So not only do you have bad workers, now you don't have any workers at all.
Yeah.
You just have nothing.
So it's kind of funny because, I don't know if you've ever experienced, when you're here in the States, working with the Motor Vehicle Administration or Division of Motor Vehicles is always an example of government inefficiency and things. I never really thought for a moment that when I went in there to get my license, get my new tags, I was being subjected to a psychological warfare game. But here's I was. It's like when you're watching a movie. It was a time when I just thought I was watching Hollywood trash and it's entertainment. But now, as I did more research and these things, it's not, like I said, it's not a cesspool. What you're watching is a weapon pointed right at you. I mean,
Yeah, I think so. And then of course everybody hates the government, and it's understandable. I mean, because you're just basically they're using it totally in the wrong way to get people all divided, and they get the idea, well, this is going to be a lot better in the hand of the kleptocrats. And then the kleptocrats just raise the prices and milk the assets. Mm-hmm. They don't put any money back into it. They just let it grind it down. They run kind of like a Sears operation. What they've done with Sears.
Yeah.
Just milk the money out and run the thing into the ground. That's how they do it.
And you can we've talked about you could finance or subsidize operations like Amazon, which are designed to destroy the local stores, brick and mortar operations with endless credit lines. Capital and what type of cultural program is being created through Amazon, right?
Yeah, and they just got the workers just they're not unionized. They're complaining about the wages.
Jeff Bezos is the richest man in the world reportedly, yet his workers their low wages are subsidized by food stamp programs and government welfare.
Yeah. Which is actually a good segue right there into talking about Argentina.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so it's just a case study of plutocratic big loan capital. Now, as background, if you go back, you had about 500 British oligarch families that got the power and the wealth during the Gilded Ages of Argentina. Mm-hmm. They were all sort of ensconced there, mostly in Buenos Aires and certain neighborhoods and out in a few of the larger regional cities. They had real strong power over the country. It was like a colony. And along came Juan Perón. I think Juan Perón was probably a aficionado of Gottfried Fedor. And in fact, he had been to Europe and kind of studied the Italian model under Mussolini and kind of picked up some ideas there. But he was just a realist. He wasn't really an ideologue. He just kind of goes, what can I do to make things better for my people? I like my people. If I'm going to be the president, I'm going to try to make things better for them. And then he actually had the good fortune of marrying Eva Perón, who was a fanatic in terms of her love of her people, because she kind of came from very humble origins. Great woman, I think. I mean, I've been doing some deep diving into her. And so she was an influence on Juan Perón. And he came up with the idea that we're going to dignify labor and we're not going to borrow from foreigners. What a novel concept. Are you with me?
Yep.
So In the process, the labor's share of national income went from 40% to 49%. Now, I should have gotten the numbers for the United States. I really should have before I came on the show, but people should go look it up. It does not look good. The labor's share of the national income is way down. It's just not high enough. So he just decided to raise wages, unionize them, really push for more rural wages, and really push for the idea of full employment. So he made sure everybody got to work, you know, working. So real wages between 1945. He started in power in about 19. He was really in power before 46, but 46 to 55 he was in power, and then that was his main regime. But he was in there prior to that as secretary of labor, secretary of war, had some cabinet positions where he was kind of pushing his program. But the real wages rose 35% between 45 and 49. Then all of a sudden you're getting this sort of more prosperity in the country. And they organized the Eva Perón Foundation. And she, I mean, admittedly, I think she actually went out and kind of extorted a lot of money. Said, you know, you're going to put some money into my fund. But she did it for the people. She didn't do it for herself. She did it so she could build hospitals and build schools and build medical facilities. So I think she was kind of inclined to be pretty rough with the oligarchs who did not like her. And then in 1946, Perón nationalized the central bank and then paid off the Bank of England. Now, one of the falsehoods about Juan Perón was that he nationalized the railroads, but that's not exactly true. That's kind of a misnomer. The railroads in Argentina were owned by foreigners, the French and the British in particular, and the French had created a credit of $650 million from importing grain during World War II, and were just holding it in England, wouldn't release it back to Perón. So Perón kept asking for the money back. The English wouldn't give it to him. He says, well, you know what? I'm going to nationalize your railroads. And then he got him to the table, and they said, okay, we'll give you your $650 million, and you can use that to nationalize the railroads and pay off our interest. So that's how he did it. Pretty shrewd, but he had to be kind of tough, a little bit almost like extortion. So for his trouble, he was subjected to U.S. embargoes and had to do – you know, they really did not want this national sovereignty thing going. The idea that a country would try to create its own path, doing it its own way with its own economic system, didn't really appeal. And eventually, George Kennan, who's the guy that ran the operations against Perón, excluded any imports for the Marshall Plan.
That's
from Argentina.
That's the George Kennan.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. What do you know about him?
I'm sorry?
What do you know about him?
Well, that's Mr. X, you know. That's the guy who wrote the long telegram and the justification for post-war containment of the Soviet Union. So he's the guy that's sort of helped set up the parameters of the Cold War. And so he's, so that's just a fine issue that he would be doing that too, sort of setting up Argentina to fail because they're straying from the playbook. Like you said, the model for Latin America, or South America, and Central America is, you know, these are supposed to be de facto colonies of the Anglo-Americans.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly. That's exactly what it is. And Perón wasn't playing that game, and his wife wasn't playing that game, particularly Perón. And so he would not approve use of foreign credits. He didn't join GATA, which is, of course, now the World Trade Organization. He wouldn't play ball with the IMF. I mean, he was really something else. I got to really admire the guy for trying it, but it's just a tough hoe. And so, sure enough, by the time 19... What happened to the Perón regime was there was a drought in 1952, and the country always depended on some exports. So if it ever ran a major trade deficit, even though they weren't borrowing, they kind of insulated themselves from currency attacks on borrowing. When they ran a trade deficit, it still, you know, it opened up an opportunity for the parasite guild to hammer on them.
Mm-hmm.
And then for some strange reason, his wife dies in 1952. And I think there's kind of maybe a rabbit hole story there, too. She's 33 years old and dies of fast-growing cervical cancer in 1952, right when things really counted, when they really needed her, because she had the, you know, total loyalty of the people. And she just drops off the scene.
Well, yeah, these people do tend to, like, conveniently die. You know, I'm thinking of Mattei in Italy, what he did with Italy's oil company, kept it from being privatized by the Seven Sisters, and he was trying to negotiate better terms with the oil producing nations, and his plane crashes, explodes.
Right.
You know, you was that banker, German, the Deutsche Bank, Herrhausen, who was kidnapped? He entertained the idea of third world debt relief, and then next thing you know, he's kidnapped by, you know, I think Red Guard or some communist organization, and he's murdered. And of course, what we know about those, what was going on in Europe in the 70s and 80s, that was Gladio, and a lot of these organizations were actually, you know, controlled or set up by NATO to create a strategy of tension in order to create this environment. Same thing, you know, supposedly even Bader-Meinhof, perhaps, was a Gladio operation. So these characters are gotten rid of, or they die conveniently. So.
Yeah, and then they're just looking for every opportunity to organize against him. And one of the things that Perón did was started pushing for divorce and women's suffrage, things like that. You know, so, I mean, he was pretty progressive, I guess. At that time, you know, he would be called a communist. But, I mean, really, women's votes and divorce. Well, these are Catholic countries.
Mm-hmm.
So the Catholic Church got organized against him, and it went downhill, and it all came to a head at on June 16th, 1955. He's holding a big rally in Buenos Aires, and Navy fighter jets flew over the crowd and shot it up and bombed him and killed 364 people. I had no idea that happened.
Whose Navy?
But think about the implications of that.
Was it Argentine's Navy?
Yeah, there.
Well, that's interesting. So inside, more or less, the army, just like in Chile or something, is being used to more or less create the conditions for a coup or an overthrow of his regime, yeah.
As it was in 364?
Yeah, 364. Yeah, so okay, we're back. Sorry, lost connection. So you're talking about he held a rally, I guess a labor rally or something. And it was,
yeah, supporters.
For supporters, and there was an attack, an aerial attack for Navy jets, an Argentine Navy?
Yep.
Okay.
They bombed the crowd to kill 364, and so that touched off a big reaction, obviously, from the Peronistas, and they kind of took it out on the churches, so they were ransacking churches, and that was the end of the regime. So he had to flee. He went up to Paraguay, got out of the country. And the country at that point was very polarized, so the powers to be, and I suppose that Perón himself brought some of it out there. He was could be contentious, but I think he was on the right path. I consider him actually in the greater scheme of things, a pretty decent guy, leader. I think his heart was in the right place. I definitely think his wife's heart was in the right place. At any rate, she. So Argentina pursues a version of it couldn't get the Peronistas completely out, but the Cruptos took over and kind of, they didn't quite get the neoliberalism implemented because it had too much pushback, but it was very divisive and the country just kind of shifted back and forth, but the Peronista party was outlawed. And then finally 1971 is when there was kind of a revival of nationalism began in Latin America and Brazil and places like that. So there was a comeback of the Peronistas. And Perón came back in 1973 and won the presidency, and he died like 9 months later. I mean, he was older, so I guess that probably wasn't a fast-growing cancer routine, but who knows? So his wife takes over. And then you had the military take over.
Yeah.
And that's when they brought in the really heavy hitting goons, the Parasite Guild operatives, and under neoliberalism, they just went hog wild on foreign borrowing. So they $7 billion of foreign borrowing, in 76, up to $43 billion by the time the military had done their magic on the country. And somebody has written up a beautiful Wikipedia on the, one of the main guys of this operation that I'll just go through. His name was Jose Martinez de Hoz, and he served as the Minister of Economy between 76 and 81 and shaped the economic policy during the National Reorganization military dictatorship. So he was the son, Sion, of one of Argentina's oldest cattle ranching families. He pursued higher studies at Cambridge University. And then following the coup against Perón, he was appointed his province's Minister of Economy. And then they, this is just going through this, he was an influential lobbyist for Ascendor, which is Argentina's largest steel manufacturer. And then De Hoz became its CEO in 68. And then 7 years later, after union laborers at the Ascendor Villa plant elected a socialist shop steward, De Hoz retaliated by using his family's long-standing connection with the armed forces to have them brutally repressed. And supported by the metal workers union leader, security forces abducted the new shop steward, Alberto Pincini, and about 300 others, almost all which were murdered. So they just picked up 300 people in the union there at his shops and murdered them. And this was going on all over Latin America. I lived in Brazil for a couple of years, and I had a Brazilian girlfriend. Mm-hmm. And her father was a union activist in the 70s, during this period, or the 80s, early 80s, when the military took over there, too.
Was this part of Condor?
I think so, yeah. He was murdered. The last time they saw him, he went to a dentist, and he picked him up on the street and took him down someplace. It came out later. Somebody told the story of what had happened to him, and so because there was reconciliation, the family kind of got all the details and actually given damages by the government, the Brazilian government, for the murder of her father. And they took him down to Sao Paulo and had some place and tortured him and then dumped his body out someplace they never even found his body. So somebody had to just tell a story later. So that's what they were doing. Very ruthless regimes. And so he basically what he did, he says here that he moved to lessen the Argentina's trade barriers quickly. So he completely liberalized trade, which he believed to be a cause of economic isolation. He enjoyed a personal relationship and friendship with David Rockefeller, who facilitated Chase Manhattan and international monetary loans.
He's a great man.
Yes, he's a great man. Following his appointment, he decreed a general freeze on wages. So here they're going to set the workers back. That's standard plantation operation of the Parasite Guild. Because you got to rape somebody, you got to get them back on the plantation working for no wages. That's critical to the whole operation. And if they get in your way, you kill them.
Yeah, the organizers are trying to use their organizational abilities to negotiate with you. There's two ways you can deal with it. You can deal with them, negotiate them fairly from across the table, or have them killed.
Yeah, that's what they did. So he already established his track record, and here he is as minister. I mean, as a private CEO, he's established his private track record, and here he is running the economy. Unbelievable. Mm-hmm. And a friend of Rockefeller. So he institutes a value-added tax and rescinds the inheritance tax. That kind of sounds familiar, doesn't it?
Well, I mean, the Rockefellers are always considered Latin America kind of their backyard, right? So,
right. Many local retailers and home builders became incapable of coping with the fall in demand and declared bankruptcy because, you killed your consumers in your domestic economy. Because all they want to do is they just want slave labor to sell abroad. They just want to export. So a billion-dollar trade deficit didn't turn around because they're exporting everything out of the country on slave labor. So there was an increase in business investment, probably from foreigners, which doesn't really say that in this Wikipedia. However, real wages lost 40% of their purchasing power, and the shock would have been worse except for there was high savings within Argentina. Inflation revived again, so he responded by deregulating all the financial markets, removing checks on banks, and transferring responsibility for any bad loans to the state. There we go again.
Well, you need you need to stimulate business.
Yeah, the bad loans get taken to the state, which takes charge of took charge of their debt as needed. So, I mean, what a bunch of crony cap? What?
I think I've seen that before.
Right. The central bank, like so many key posts in the Martinez de Hoz era, was led by one of a number of Chicago boys, Alfredo Diez. Diez enacted much of this economy minister's financial deregulation policy while moving to limit domestic credit. So there you again, you're going to this big capital, big loan capitalism, you're using foreigners rather than the domestic smaller forms of capital.
Now, who set up the University of Chicago?
That was Rockefeller's, wasn't it?
Yeah. I mean, this is what they do with the, you see a lot of these economists, whether it's Cambridge, London School of Economics, University of Chicago, is these economists, these experts are more or less, these are guys that they're used under the cover of academia, more like they're a priest for the oligarchs. They come out and they'll use their jargon to justify these policies and these things.
Right.
And, to institutionalize these things. And to the point where the average man in the street doesn't feel like he's informed enough or educated enough to question them.
Right. Yeah. So then they move on to raise the reserve requirements on bank deposits to 45%. So that just completely shuts off any kind of activity in Argentina. Mm-hmm. And which thereby doubling borrowers' interest rates while eliminating the yields on demand deposits. So the few people that have loans out there have really high interest rates. It's giant spreads for the banks.
Yeah. it's financialization of the economy. This is between 1974 and 1981?
Yeah, 76 to 81.
So this is kind of like during the oil crisis, which was fomented by Kissinger, the Yom Kippur War, the 400% increase in the price of oil. And this is also in the context, 1974 arose that Kissinger's memorandum.
74, Perón was still in power, so 76. Okay. Yeah, but in that period, it's basically, it's sort of a carryover from the Kissinger, Gerald Ford nonsense, whatever they were doing.
Because this sort of austerity with you can see that with Kissinger, this National Security Study Memorandum 200, where he calls for the depopulation of the developing world through austerity, more or less, and also the imposition, sort of like the imposition of population control policies, making contingent on food, dependent on foreign aid for food. Obviously, the explosion of price of energy caused these countries to go more and more into debt, which would precipitate the debt crisis in the 80s, right? So,
yeah, I mean, we introduced in our last talk, I introduced the concept of Hammond's razor, which so never attribute to malice, what you can attribute to incompetence. No, especially come on.
Especially when you have white papers and memorandums calling for the very policies that have been implemented. Secretary of State.
They found some friggin' catastrophic guy and put him in there and carried out the ruination of this country. Mm-hmm. So then it says short-term financial speculation flourished while chronic tax evasion and public budget deficits remained high. Frequent wage freezes decreased, continued to depress living standards, and income inequality increased. So the speculators are making some money. You got some speculators that are doing okay. During his tenure, the foreign debt increased fourfold. And the disparities between the upper and lower class became very pronounced. And then the period ended in a tenfold devaluation of the currency and the worst financial crisis in Argentine history. So then they got them out of there after they wrecked the economy. And it's kind of interesting to see what this guy's career is afterwards. I mean, what a sick, evil bastard.
What is he? You go to work for the UN or something?
I got involved in some, here. Where is it? Okay, goes on. It talks about how the money soon found itself in risky gambles at home and abroad. And when one bank's Ponzi scheme collapsed in March 1980, and Martinez de Hoz responded to the passable panic by luring investors with one-year treasuries paying 60% in U.S. dollars. Facing these pressures, the Argentine peso increasingly became the object of short selling by insiders, including de Hoz himself.
So he must have been hired. Eventually, must have been hired by Goldman Sachs.
Yeah, something like that.
With a resume like this. I mean, geez.
So the
he's shorting his own country's currency. I love that.
Yeah, brokerage houses proliferated as put options against the peso increased sharply, and so then he announced the unthinkable: the time had come for a sharp devaluation. So he just set the whole thing up. They get these put options out there against the currency, and then go, and then after everybody's on board, he goes, okay, we're going to devalue, you're going to get the payoff. But you get the worst financial crisis in the history of modern Argentina. Speculators quickly took advantage of the deregulation to write off their debts. Legitimate borrowers were faced with suddenly unaffordable U.S. dollar payments, and homeowners' monthly payments rose by tenfold during the next 15 months. Nice job. And then they had the war.
Yeah, the Falklands War. Yeah.
As a little distraction. And then that's when the government came down. De Hoz was indicted in 1988 for his involvement in human rights abuses and spent 77 days in jail. Quickly freed, he finally benefited from a pardon by President Carlos Menem. Now, Carlos Menem, we'll talk about a little bit. We don't have to get into him too much. But he was the guy they brought in 89 later to put the Washington Consensus into play and really privatize the country, you know, get the whole country just totally twisted. Then de Hoz returned to the world of high finance despite a 1992 conviction of operating a brokerage with a revoked license. And he became the member of the board of directors of two arbitrage houses, Rome Group and Banco Central de Negocios, the general business bank. So he's on the board of director of a couple banks. The general business bank, now defunct, later helped clients illegally wire $30 billion out of the country prior to the December 2001 financial crisis. So enough of that guy. I think you got the idea.
Mm-hmm. It's incredible how they fail upward.
Yeah.
And they never really suffer any consequences.
77 days in jail, that's kind of better than we're doing now. I mean, at least they got a little... At least it kind of interrupted his rhythm a little bit. But
yeah, the good old days. But I just love the fact that he's in a position to determine monetary policy for his country. At the same time, he's shorting the very currency he's conspiring to devalue.
Yeah, what a corrupt deal.
I mean, that's just, I mean.
Yeah, so post the generals, they basically got into more neoliberalism, including they tried a new currency. That didn't work. But, you know, the bottom line of this whole story is the debt never goes away. The debt is always there. It's always being renegotiated. And then you have one crisis after another. And so after the next crisis, under Menem, you had the 1998-2002 Great Depression in Argentina, they called it.
Mm-hmm.
And that's when guys like Paul Elliott Singer and Ken Dark came in and scooped up all the debt, and they tried to renegotiate the debt. They got a deal with the creditors, but Singer and Dart held up. It's called the holdout. So then you get into this whole idea of never reducing the debt because somebody's going to buy some debt and not agree to restructuring it. And so they had a 70% haircut set up with most of the creditors.
Yeah.
But the thing that actually gave Singer and Dart standing in court is that the IMF was treated as a privileged creditor in all this. So even with the rest of the bondholders getting a haircut, the IMF did not. And so Singer was able to argue in his New York court, where it was handled, that this is pari passu. You can't treat debtors differently. Well, they're doing the same thing in Europe. I mean, the same thing happened in Greece. The IMF was treated as privileged. The ECB is treated as privileged. They did a haircut, but it kind of affected Aunt Millie again. So you're always going after Aunt Millie. So finally, they were able to pay off the IMF in full, but they whittled down their central bank reserves of 28 to 16 billion in the process. So that's just a very, very typical operation. Joseph Stiglitz, I mean, you got some guys like Joseph Stiglitz saying that the IMF shouldn't receive the same treatment as all the other debtors, pari passu. But then what that does is, in a way, it's sort of controlled opposition, because what Stiglitz is basically saying is Singer is right. Mm-hmm. He's backing up their court case. So I think this stuff is very rigged and planned. And they just got them coming and going.
And apparently, this case involved a seizing of an Argentine vessel.
Yeah, that they tried that and seized a battleship in Ghana at port. Singer managed to arrange that. But,
whose military force would do that on Singer's behalf?
I don't know. God, I must have bribed somebody. Only thing I can think of.
Like, is it like Blackwater or something?
Yeah, something like that. There's so many rabbit holes on this stuff. There really is.
We could just dig
and find. We probably would find Blackwater, but I don't want to say it because I don't know.
Yeah, I mean, that's interesting, because I remember I was reading E. Michael Jones' book, Barren Metal, and he's writing about the Don Pacifico affair. And Don Pacifico, David Pacifico, was a British subject who renounced his British citizenship for Portuguese citizenship. And apparently he had some debt in Greece, and there was some sort of riot or something, and his house was ransacked and the records were burned of his debt. And since property was damaged, and he had a claim against the Greek government for not taking action protecting his property. And it turns out that the British Navy came in on his behalf and threatened to shell Athens if they didn't pay him. He weren't to collect on his debt. And it turns out that Don Pacifico was a Rothschild agent. And so this is even an example of a private debt claim being backed up by a force of a sovereign nation, the British Empire, the British Navy. And of course, at the same time, the British Navy claims it doesn't have enough resources to bring relief to the starving Irish at the time. This is the 1840s. Right. So, I mean, so this is an example, again, of gunboat diplomacy being used to secure the collections for a private citizen.
There's a happy ending to this Ghana story is that the international courts made Singer give the battleship back. Justice prevailed. So
he buys the debt cheap and then wants to collect 100 cents on the dollar.
Yeah, and you know, yeah. he's made a lot of money on it, but they still haven't resolved this because he keeps. The situation would have been resolved. It would have been a haircut of the some of the debtors, and Argentina would have been in a lot better shape. But this stuff all goes back. It doesn't go back to Perón. Perón didn't borrow any money. Mm-hmm. Everybody wants to act like it's the Peronistas that did all this. Bullshit. Total bullshit. These are the lies that are promulgated about who's responsible for this stuff. It's clearly in the hands of this military junta and this criminal. De Hoze, whoever he was working with, Rockefeller, obviously. Mm-hmm. So the blame goes with these people. And the thing I don't like about the story is the American media, the way they cover Perón in particular. I mean, most people listening to this podcast probably think Perón's kind of a irresponsible bum.
Yeah.
Because that's the propaganda.
Yeah, that's the impression I got, like, reading Paul Johnson's Modern Times and things like that about Perón, yeah. A spendthrift, typical Latin American, strongman.
Well, he put a standard safety net in his country, but safety nets don't cost that much. You know, and then he built up the infrastructure. I mean, the infrastructure of Argentina was built up just like Huey Long in Louisiana. You know, I remember as a kid driving through Louisiana, and every bridge said built in 1936 under the Governor Huey Long regime. I remember that as a kid in Louisiana. Well, that's what it was with Perón. So he really built the infrastructure up through the Eva Perón Foundation and did it a lot with private money. Not even spending a lot of the government's money. That's a good way to do it.
Well, at least you have some. Once the money is spent, you have infrastructure to use.
Yeah.
As opposed to being lost like going down the rat hole of the Pentagon or something.
Yeah. So they actually left Argentina with a legacy and not a bunch of debt. So lay off the Perones. I'm not going to get involved in that. So. Then there's another side story about this debt forgiveness and this debt dealing with debt that's kind of interesting. We'll just cover that briefly. And that's the Dawes Plan of 1924, mm-hmm. involving German reparations for World War I. And so they stretched it out. That's what they do. They renegotiate. They see that they're not willingly paying it, and they have to make some steps. Well, that's what they did with Greece. Exactly what they did. So they get them off the hook for a while by stretching out the payments for some period of time. And then 1929, they had to do it again, so they decided to reduce the payment by 20%, but not the debt.
Yeah.
See how the game's played? We're going to reduce your payment, not the debt. And that was the Young Plan. That was put together by Owen Young, who was the one of the top honchos of the Rockefeller Foundation.
Yes.
And J.P. Morgan under Thomas Lamont. And that name keeps coming up. And Thomas Lamont, I'm going to have to dig down a little deeper on, too, do some deep diving on him. And so basically what they did is they took the debt, the reparation collections, and kind of pretty much made the U.S. banks the creditors.
Mm-hmm.
Instead of the governments. And I think, I'm assuming that probably what happened, I'd have to check the details, is the government might have paid some token amount to the government for the securitization, for the reparation securitization.
Mm-hmm.
So then the Depression hit, and Hoover gave the Germans a one-year moratorium, realizing they couldn't pay because Germany was really hit. And so then they had a conference in 1932, and the conference was held right before Hitler was about ready to be elected. And right when Germany was really on its back, and so they realized at that late date that they had to pretty much reduce the debt, but they did it informally. They formally reduced the debt by 90% and said, don't worry, we'll deal with this later. It was never formally forgiven. It was informally reduced. So Hitler comes in and repudiates the whole thing. And so at that point, nobody was interested in collecting. They'd pretty much given up at the Lausanne conference. Well, it gave Hitler an opportunity to do a victory dance.
Mm-hmm.
Nice job. Nice job. He gets to be the big hero for his people. And just to prove that old debts never die, a New York Times article, October 3rd, 2010, Germany made its final World War I reparation payment. That's called the long game, Tim.
That's what, 91 years after the Versailles Treaty, yeah.
Yeah, and securitizing it. I mean, I'd have to find out the whole story of who securitized it and who got paid off. I mean, that would be a fascinating story, too. It just, every time you do these research on these topics, it just leads to more weird shit, doesn't it?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, don't you find that to be the case? I sure do.
Yeah.
And I wish I had a whole staff of young whippersnappers to do all this stuff, but they don't exist. And the ones that do exist, they get taken down offline.
Well, yeah, no, there's not going to be any foundation funding in a long-term economic study of these things. It's like most of the economic research in the United States is funded by the Federal Reserve. So it's going to be, panegyric in favor of the Federal Reserve. That's why these basic assumptions never get questioned by officialdom or anything. Or you and I can identify sort of, you know, just the insanity of the banking system. But the banking system is intentionally unstable. They want it that way because they can orchestrate booms and busts and panics, and which ultimately lead to a further, you know, centralization or transfer of wealth. Every bust is a transfer of wealth in one form or another, whether it's monetary or actual resources. I think it was Norman Dodd who was the chief investigator for the Reese Committee.
Was interesting. Yeah, that was really interesting.
And the foundations, and of course, in an interview he did a while back in the early 80s, he talks about at the one time he was involved in banking. And this was in the, in 1930-31, and there he was charged with coming up with a reform for the banking system. And he came up with an idea of a banking system that is stable and 100% reserve banking. And they said, well, no, we don't want that. We want a banking system that is intentionally unstable. Because with instability, you can start a whisper campaign and create a panic, like they did in 1907, probably what they did in 1929. And, you know, this was foreseen. I mean, when they created the Federal Reserve Bank in the United States, there was those who kind of saw for what it was. One was, of course, Congressman Charles Lindbergh, the aviator's father. And he had a quote regarding the Federal Reserve Act. And he also opposed the entry of U.S. entries into World War One. There's a connection there, of course, between that and the creation of the central bank. But he had this quote. He said, "This act establishes the most gigantic trust on earth. When the president signs this bill, the invisible government of the monetary power will be legalized. The worst legislative crime of the ages is perpetrated by this banking and currency bill." And so he recognized for what it was, because then he's been relegated to, you know, to the ash heap of history.
Yeah, and then meanwhile, fast forward 100 years later, and you got Janet Yellen just openly saying, "Let's just blow bubbles continually." I mean,
yeah, something as early as 20 years ago would be considered insane, right?
Yeah,
or even pre 2008,
15 years ago. Yeah, 10 years ago.
Because if you look at the Fed's balance sheet, I think as early as 2007 or 8, before the crisis, it was like just under $900 billion. Now it's like $5 trillion. You know, and I wonder if that Dodd
interview is online. I've watched that. I bet you that one's been scrubbed, too.
Yeah.
We should check that one out. That's a really good interview.
Yeah, but the banking system is intentionally the whole global financial system is intentionally unstable. And there's a reason why it is. The reason why do we accept the idea of banking financial panics? Because these are panics that are like wars. These are stirred up by people that have an interest in having the panics and creating a pretext for, you know, transferring wealth, seizing the reforms. Good example, 2008, you know, was a pretext for Goldman Sachs and J.P. Morgan Bank and to get bigger, despite the fact that they were the main culprits, you know.
Yeah, in fact, that's a good point, because let's go into this. We can maybe kind of wrap this up on this one. And exactly what you just said. You got Spain's big banks. Now, here's what happened in Spain. When they had the last crisis, there were two big banks that rolled all the caca into the two. BBVA and Banco Santander, and they rolled they got $100 billion loan from the ECB cheap for practically nothing, because they couldn't raise deposits. All these banks were weak, so the ECB loans them money. And do they hang around in Spain making small loans or, you know, business loans? No, they got $100 billion. We've got to go overseas, so they take $167 billion into Brazil, $160 billion into Mexico, $28 billion into Argentina. And so the loans that these two Spanish big banks have made in these Latin American countries and Turkey. So Turkey was actually bought out by BBVA. Yeah, BBVA bought Turkey. I can't pronounce it. A big Turkish bank. By buying this bank, the already insolvent BBVA now owns an enormous amount of bad Turkish debt. Because all the lending is done in dollars or in euros, not in local currencies, because the borrowers can borrow cheap in euros because the money is so cheap. But when the currencies collapse, they have to pay back in dollars, and they can't do it. That's what's being set up. So you've got two banks that have done exactly what you just talked about. They rolled them up, made them bigger, gave them, enabled them, winked, winked, and looked the other way, where they just went around the world speculating on arbitrage, and now they're in big trouble again. And the media hardly even talks about it. But look at the stock prices of these stocks. They're just eroding away. They're in big trouble. So even with the Fed just baby stepping this quantitative tightening, you've got stuff breaking in Argentina, Turkey, Indonesia, Brazil, India, Tunisia. You know, Mexico has been kind of spared because they're playing ball on NAFTA. Mm-hmm. So I think they're blackmailing him, extorting him. You know, they got the new president in there, and they're saying, "Hey, you cooperate with us, and we'll spare you."
Yeah.
For now.
Now he's supposed so that sparring, kind of brings us up Trump to
the president on this stuff. And if there's any traders in the audience, you might take note that on September, the Fed is reducing their balance sheet all on one or two days. They'll go 6 weeks without reducing the balance sheet and then do it all days they were reducing it.
Yeah, the number, in 2 days, they're going to cut the
Okay, yeah, so I got it all.
We're
all
back right. again. I'm That's sorry, cool. lost connection. Go ahead.
Yeah, so they're piling these into 1 and 2 day periods, which is very, very odd. And I would suggest that's to set up a bust at some point, because it's just going to be too much strain for the system. Too much breaking already. If you keep pulling this money out on certain days instead of just spreading it out more evenly, it's more strain on the system. It's kind of like a heart attack. Oh, and I found Steve Bannon's documentary for anybody who would like to have a look. This is probably still online. It's called Generation Zero.
Generation Zero?
Hello?
Yeah. Can you hear me?
Hello? Yeah.
Yeah, can you hear me?
Yeah.
Okay. Generation Zero?
So it's Steve Bannon's documentary, Generation Zero. So that's something people might want to check out.
Yeah, and that's the one thing is they'll talk about austerity and cutting pensions and these things for the little guy, but then you have these huge bailouts for Goldman Sachs and J.P. Morgan.
That doesn't look like that's going to end, because the Trump crew, he's brought in a lot of these guys, a lot of these parasite guildists are in his administration, so he's totally prepared to play ball on it, if he even lasts. I mean, personally, I think he might be taken down. What did you think of the incident with his Lodestar story, where the so-called White House official uses the word Lodestar in that op-ed piece of the New York Times?
Yeah, that's. I think that a lot of that is just being. You know
who uses the term, don't you?
Who?
Mike Pence.
Oh, that's right. That's right. And that's right. Yeah. This sort of some of those politics I don't always get involved with, but yeah, they're trying to set, as Mike Pence is being the guy. This is the 25th Amendment thing, right?
Well, I think he is the guy. Yeah. I've always maintained that. I mean, there's no surprise to me. I mean, everybody says, well, they're just trying to make it look like Mike Pence does it to get some dissension in the White House. I don't think so. That's my opinion. I think I've always thought Trump is a stalking horse for Mike Pence. Mike Pence has been completely untouchable. You never hear anything really negative about him.
Mm-hmm.
It all goes against Trump. Trump's the fall guy.
Yeah, he's a committed Zionist too, Mike Pence.
Yeah, they both are. Well, so they both are. That's always a constant.
Well, I mean, he's been bailed out. I mean, Trump, I think, wasn't Wilbur Ross was the guy to negotiate the bailout of Resorts International? And then Mnuchin, I think he's a Goldman Sachs flunky, right?
Yeah, and I doubt if Pence will get rid of those guys. We'd probably leave him around. So, I think we're kind of coming up in a really interesting period here in the next few weeks and going into October, and both the political crisis, economic crisis, it just looks kind of primed. And the Argentina experience, they probably have somebody like Dehose in the wings.
Well, I mean, a lot of people, Americans, will look at the Greeks and go, look at these guys. They don't want to work for a living. They want to bail out. They want to be on welfare and go easy. And then you'll look at some of the Latin American countries that have been victimized by neoliberal policies. And you make a good case is that the policy, it's very sophisticated strategy, because the Rockefellers, Rothschilds will sort of will install the kakistocracy, these strongmen or buffoons who do create a fiscal train wreck to justify the neoliberal foreclosure on the country, which is sort of the economic hitman model. But the United States, it's still the de facto world reserve currency, the U.S. dollar, but it's got a $22 trillion reported debt. Let's do this. Okay, we're back. The United States has the world reserve currency, which gives it incredible privilege abroad to run these outrageous debts and these things, $22 trillion in debt. But as you write in the articles, the U.S. government, the U.S. economy and the American people are potentially being set up for something you might see in Argentina or Greece. Because the only difference would be what would be the geopolitical ramifications of such a thing. But again, it goes down. We're not dealing with an economic question. Ultimately, it's sort of it's a military question.
Yeah, and plus it's political. They're using sanctions on everybody. Yeah. They're abusing that. They're using on everybody, threatening sanctions. Mm-hmm. And people are just used up all the goodwill. It's pretty obvious. Pretty obvious that they don't really have the goodwill of a lot of the world to do this stuff. And if they want to get a war going in the Middle East, that's going to have repercussions. Very, very reckless behavior. But I actually think it's by design.
Yeah. A good example is you cite with Turkey, their problems with their banking system. Well, Turkey has been cooperated with Russia in regards to Syria. So maybe this is punishment and for Turkey, making it bringing Turkey back in the NATO fold. And it is a member of NATO officially. So NATO's operations in Iraq have created a lot of problems for Turkey, particularly vis-a-vis the Kurds and in Iraq, and also what's going on in Syria. NATO and American foreign policy has driven Russia into the arms of the Chinese. Right. So if you get a situation where Russia aligns with China economically, so you have Russia. China has all these factories, courtesy of the Rockefellers now, part of their trilateralist plan back in the 70s and 80s. If Russia, with its resources, can align with that, and you also have Russia realizing that its interests lie maybe in the heart of Europe with Germany, and you have this German-Russian-Chinese condominium. Well, how does the Leviathan, the Anglo-American Zaire Empire, maintain control?
Yeah, it doesn't fit in with anything anymore.
No. Yeah.
It really doesn't. They need what the United States needs is Juan Perón to basically come back and restore its people. It needs a lot of work spent on its people, putting investment into its people, into the infrastructure of the country, domestic, and get. I mean, it's obvious. That's not isolationism. That's self-preservation. But they won't do it. They're addicted. Yes. They're addicted, and they're controlled by a bunch of kakistocracies.
Well, yeah, I mean, they'd rather spend $7 trillion in Iraq and in Afghanistan, borrowed, by the way, at interest, than do something like that, spending a fraction at home. This goes back to the 1970s when the collapse of the Bretton Woods system and the creation of the petrodollar, and this created, this macroeconomic environment where the dollar is de facto world reserve currency. So then really what you have is you have imports that are coming in at a subsidized price, and it's also it artificially increases the value of the dollar, which leads to the deindustrialization of the United States, which was planned. I guess it goes back to this isn't a coincidence or accident. They wanted the plan of deindustrialization of the United States, and then they make up the difference with credit and debt. And if that's what you see, the exploding rat amounts of debt, both private, you know, personal, corporate, and government, this is all a function of those decisions that were taken in the 1970s.
Well, if these other countries decide to toss the dollar, which is totally in their interest to do, mm-hmm. it's going to come back in the United States and create a huge inflation.
Yeah.
And there's signs of it already. I mean, they're already, inflation is creeping up. So the Fed is really in a tough spot. They have to kind of keep tightening, and probably they're going to end up having to tighten a lot. And then you're going to get the financial markets finally breaking. And when that happens, the confidence will be lost because people are asleep because you got these bubbles. They sleep through the bubbles. Then they react through the crashes.
Yeah.
So we're due for that. And then that'll wake people up. And if the United States had a Juan and Eva Perón, I would have a little bit of hope if they had some people like that. But I don't think they do. I don't think they're capable of having decent people like that that actually care.
Well, the political class and even the financial, the people who control the financial world are all, so we say, transnational cosmopolitans.
Yeah.
Rootless cosmopolitans. And the government itself is controlled, the political class, Congress, is controlled by foreign governments. You guess which one, I guess. But, when a foreign prime minister can come here and give a speech and receive 29 standing ovations.
I hope that keeps. I hope that keeps this podcast on the YouTube. When you said that, I hope nobody mentions that in comments.
It's the elephant in the room.
Right. Oh boy.
It's completely controlled, bought out. It's bought out by these business interests that are. They're largely that, you could say that. The method for control is pretty easy. It's a combination of bribery, blackmail, and threats. And that's how they control the political process. That's why they have, that's why when you talk about kakistocracy, that's why when you talk in these other, when you've discussed on your written about on your article, sort of the sex scandals and these things, that's all part of the control process,
Yep. Pedophilia, yeah. Basically, yeah, they've got a bunch of pedophiles, especially in places like the UK.
Mm-hmm. And so you can't expect a cabal.
Have you gotten into that topic on any of your shows?
Oh, yeah. The Franklin scandal and these things and the Dutroux affair in Belgium, that involves NATO and government officials there. And these things are all highly, these are mid-level operators, and these are human trafficking. And that's one thing that the system does is in Puerto Rico, I think you touched on this in one of your pieces, of course, with Puerto Rico, some of these countries, even with Haiti, we saw this with Haiti, is when you collapse an economy or destabilize it, the human beings themselves become resources to be exploited, whether it's cheap labor or human trafficking or even the organ market,
Yeah, they don't want people getting too well off. They really don't. They start sticking, they start making some progress, having some nice homes, having some decent job, having at least working.
Mm-hmm.
They don't like that. They really hate that. That just goes to show how evil the system is.
Mm-hmm.
Just kind of on a side note, have you been following in this Smiley case? Smiley face killings?
Weird stories about those sort of ritualistic killings and that smiley face, it's painted somewhere,
Yeah, there's all these young men that are just being showing up in water. And I think there's somebody behind that. I think that's either high-ranking military doing it or it's a big cover-up.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it just stinks to high water, and nobody's giving it any attention. The media barely covers it, but it just happens over and over again almost every week. You go to a site called Drowning Victims.
Mm-hmm.
There's one of the key researchers that follows this. This is scary. This is some kind of it's about 200 of them. It does not add up. These boys are being murdered. They're being lured. After hours, after parties, after events, they're being lured, being picked up, tortured, water tortured, and then dumped in water. So it gives the appearance they're drowned.
Yeah.
Nobody's really covering it.
Well, I mean, you have, in fact, there's, you know, there's elements of being ritualistic in these things. This would, you know, suggest right. some sort of, you know, satanic organization or secret society. And again, these things have been
very underground. So they're all connected. It's underground. They're working together. And I think what they're doing is they're planning these murders. And they're working in the right towns where they have some people planted in there. There's clusters of them. One of them is La Crosse, Wisconsin. There's a bunch of them going on in Georgia. There's something mm-hmm. wrong with the Georgia law enforcement. They're just not, again, I don't believe in Hanlon's razor. I simply don't. Prove me wrong.
Yeah, there was that state senator Schaefer down in Georgia, which she was uncovering how Child Protective Services was being utilized as child trafficking. Sex trafficking, and they were utilizing the foster care system, and they would target, you know, I guess vulnerable families, and they'd get these children adopted. And what happened is there's actually a federal law that was signed by originally passed in the 70s, but then increased by Bill Clinton in the 90s, which rewards Child Protective Service workers for getting children who are in foster care adopted. And so there's a built-in incentive to more or less kidnap these kids, and you just target a vulnerable family that has, you know, very little resources to hire a lawyer to defend themselves, nor do they are likely to know their rights. And they're so this is some suggestion. This I think it was it Barbara Schaefer or Shemmy say? And of course, then she was a victim of a murder suicide.
Yeah, with her husband. Yeah, that was totally ridiculous.
And they say, well, that was Georgia. Their house was about to be foreclosed upon, so there's some financial reverses and all that. So was that the usual reaction that an elderly couple has? Has a big family?
Yeah. I had an interest. I'll share this with you, and then maybe we can wrap it up. Yeah. But I have an interesting experience to share with everybody. I'm not going to even say the city I am. You know where it is, but mm-hmm. I'm in Europe, and I was down at my favorite outdoor cafe about 3 months ago, and this guy's. He's got a camera and he's pointing in my direction. I'm sitting out in the cafe and he's coming out this kind of one of the second doors of the restaurant. Mm-hmm. And he's pointing this camera at me, and I thought, well, there's two girls sitting right in front of me. Maybe he's taking a picture of them. And then I looked at the girls, and one of them was kind of a dog, and the other one was kind of okay. I mean, not a knockout, nothing to be taking pictures of, you know. Bother people. And so then he goes down and he goes down to the end of the cafe, and he's kind of behind this little bush over there, and he's aiming the camera in my direction again, and I kind of ducked behind the people sitting next to me so they couldn't really take the picture. And then he kind of goes over and just acts nonchalant, and, mm-hmm. and he's with like a table with two other people. And then they leave, and then all of a sudden I got my iPad, my Apple iPad, and I open it up, and the thing comes on and says, "I am not a spy."
Really?
Yeah. Yeah.
That's bizarre.
That is bizarre. I mean, but nothing's happened since, but I think it's kind of maybe a little bit of a message. So I'm throwing that out there. I'm just letting everybody know. And the thing is, I should have taken a picture of it, but I didn't quite know how to work it. My son was kind of showing me. He said, "You should have taken a photo of that. Here's what you do." But I didn't know, you know, I didn't know how to work the camera mechanism.
So I'm sorry, your computer,
my iPad, Apple iPad,
your iPad. So you said it was not hijacked, but it was taken.
Well, you have the Sierra thing or whatever it's called.
And
normally it doesn't even come on. I mean, I hardly ever see it. It just kind of came on, and it says, "I am not a spy." So, yeah, I think somebody basically kind of hijacked. I think they probably took the pictures maybe to, you know, maybe they just wanted to make an ID on me.
Yeah, I mean, that's it.
And then send a message. And so I kind of expected, oh, my God, I'm going to be gang stalked. You know, I'll get ready for that.
Yeah, I've done shows on that, and that's an issue where it's so easy to write off as someone's paranoia. And I think there probably are people who are not well and imagine these things. But nevertheless, there's a real program for that when they have – it's been explained to me how it works. And, you know, there are governments that have done this in the past, and we all know that the in the East German government, the Stasi had a program called Disintegration, where they would harass, gang stalk, and sort of disintegrate a person's life and lead them to despair and perhaps suicide by slowly destroying his life. And
yeah, but after this incident, I'm kind of waiting for that, but yeah, Nothing's happened.
yeah, I mean, it's like, you know, and there's been programs that, you know, they can target someone just to see how it works. And, you know, you can be a target because it pulled out at random, or you cut someone off in traffic who's connected, who knows somebody. So we'll pick on this guy now. Or you have a dispute with your neighbor.
I'd be a target. Yeah, I'd be a target because of what I ride.
Yeah.
So, and I'm not fitting into the little box. So that's the reason I'd be a target.
You know, and these programs do exist, and they're feasible. It's not like, you know, there's psychological warfare, there's intimidation, these things, and they've, when you have a lot of money to throw at a program, a lot of people willing to do anything for money, and you can tell these people, yeah, this person is a suspect, he's a pedophile, or he's a...
Well, the guy looked, he was kind of a military-looking guy.
Yeah.
You know, not young military, 30s type guy, contractor type.
Yeah.
Maybe even American. He even kind of looked American. He's got this camera taking pictures of girls? I don't think so.
Yeah, and
they weren't that hot.
You pay someone $500 a day to go harass somebody, people are willing to do that.
Yeah. Yeah, or just go send this guy a message, if nothing else. You know, I mean, make him just rattle his cage a little bit. Yeah. It kind of got my attention. Mm-hmm. It hasn't stopped me, though.
No, huh? So. Okay, well, Russ, Lewis, I want to thank you.
Okay, thanks, Tim.
Coming on the show. Okay, that's so the website now you want is winterwatch, right? .net?
Yeah, winterwatch.net.
And they can go to in
a little more low profile name.
Okay, there you go. And of course, they can still find your Parasite Guild series there. You go to read those articles. This is what we talked about today. So, well, thank you.
Okay, thanks, Tim.
Enjoy it. Enjoy the late summer there. It gets very, very late summer there. So, okay, bye-bye.
Bye.